Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Prairie's on our mind on the show today. Neil DeBoll back with us. He's the president of Prairie Nursery, recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. It'll be great to have him back. We can talk with him about what to do in a native garden in the fall. As always, take your prairie gardening questions as well. So what would you like to know about getting your prairie garden ready for fall? Join in. Give a call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Neil DeBoll, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again, Larry. It's always great to be on Garden Talk with you.
Well, I tell you what, we've gotten many questions over the years about when to seed prairies, in the spring or fall, and there are some differences.
There are, and the timing of your seeding will depend on what your goals are as far as the type of prairie plant community that you would want to create. And there's a very distinct difference between seeding in the fall, which would be September, October, November, which is called a dormant seeding, meaning very few, if any, of the seeds would germinate in the fall. They sit in the ground over the winter and come up the following spring, versus a spring or early summer prairie seeding. And normally we seed prairies in May or June. Try and get them in by June 30th because, well, by June 30th, we're almost halfway through the growing season. So you want to give the little seedlings enough time to develop sufficient root systems to make it through the winter. So the difference between seeding in the fall as a dormant seeding versus seeding in spring, May or June, is that a fall seeded prairie will invariably result in higher germination of the flowers and lower germination of the warm season prairie grasses. So why is this? That's because many of your native wildflowers require exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soil over the winter to break seed dormancy and stimulate germination. And this is just a basic survival strategy because let's say I'm a prairie seed and I fall on the ground early September when I'm ripe, and it's raining and it's warm and I germinate, and then all of a sudden it's November and boom, I'm out of the gene pool. Never got to be a significant, large, big enough seedling. I'm gone. So these seeds have quote-unquote learned, if I might anthropomorphize, that if they are exposed to cold, damp conditions, then that tells them, hey, we've been through winter, the soil's warming up, now it's safe to germinate. So a lot of your species will show significantly improved and higher germination rates when seeded in the fall. Some actually require this exposure, not all, but there are some that will not germinate at all. If I plant them in April, May, or June, I'll get zero germination. If I plant them in the fall, I can get 90% germination the following spring. So this is great for the flowers, but your warm season grasses like little bluestem, big bluestem, Indian grass, Cytos grama, generally do very poorly when seeded in the fall. Something happens to that seed. It deteriorates over the winter. I don't know what it is, but you see really significantly reduced germination the following spring. But if you seed the warm season grasses in May or June, and generally we would do that at the same time as you plant corn, because corn is actually closely related to these warm season prairie grasses, and we get very good germination on the grasses, and we can get good germination on many of the flowers as well, but not as high as if we had seeded in the fall. There's a third option, and that is called a frost seeding, which is intermediate between these two. And if you have a prepared site where all the weeds have been controlled, rather than seeding it dormant in September, October, November, you can go out in late February, early March, when maybe there's a few inches of snow on the ground. Maybe the soil is bare, but you can spread the seed onto the ground, which is frozen at night and thaws during the day, and the frost heave in the soil opens up little openings where the seeds can go down into the soil, and there is sufficient time to get this cold, damp treatment on many of the flower seeds, but yet you don't see the same deterioration of germination in the warm season prairie grasses. So you can get kind of the best of both worlds. Yeah. And if you're doing a broadcast seeder, you can go out on the frozen ground first thing in the morning and seed it, and then as the day warms up, maybe the soil turns kind of muddy, but you've already got your seed in the ground before you get stuck in the mud.
And mud reminds me of soil preparation, because that's really important to, no matter when you're doing it, you want to have good soil preparation.
If you're not going to prepare the site properly and get rid of all the weeds and grasses and existing vegetation before you put your seed down, don't even start the project, because it will probably fail and you'll waste your time and money. So it's super important that you first and foremost do an inventory of what the vegetation is, and then develop your plan to eliminate that vegetation. Whether you're using herbicides or doing it organically, you can use either method, but you need to make sure you have a plan that will be successful. And sometimes it might take up to 2 years to eliminate the vegetation that's there before you even start planting. So we have a variety of different situations. The absolute easiest and best is a farm field that was planted to Roundup Ready soybeans the year before, because there's hardly a weed to be found. And it's usually a pretty smooth level field without a lot of trash on it. Now, soybeans do, after they harvest it and combine it, there is still a lot of plant material, but it's not nearly as much as a cornfield with all the corn stubble and corn stalks. A Roundup Ready cornfield is also great because there's very few, if any, weeds in that, but you will have more extensive site preparation to work the ground up in order to get it in condition for seeding. But these usually have the lowest weed levels. Mm-hmm. The next lowest weed level would be in an established lawn that's been in a manicured lawn that's been in lawn for decades, which has been mowed and sprayed and weeds have been controlled. And so you generally have a very low level of weeds, not to mention also low levels of weed seeds lurking in the soil dormant because they've not been allowed to grow for decades if it's been a properly or highly maintained lawn. So those are your three best scenarios. Of course, working up a lawn, a sod of a lawn, is a challenging process. So it's really hard to go in with a rototiller and till up sod. If anybody has ever taken a rototiller, a walk behind rototiller into the sod, they know when the rototiller starts running away across the yard ahead of you, bouncing off the soil, it's not a fun process. So you do need to normally kill the sod in the spring if you're using herbicides. Let it sit all summer, maybe spray again once or twice, and then till it in the fall when the sod has deteriorated. It makes a huge difference. Or if it's a small area, you can simply smother it and use no herbicides whatsoever. So a lot of people on small areas will smother. If you don't want to use black plastic, which is really kind of not a real ecological way to go because you're using a product that comes from oil and then it's very difficult to recycle, so it usually ends up in the landfill, you can use cardboard, big cardboard boxes from appliances, and smother the area for a full growing season. And this will kill most grasses and weeds, with the exception of a few really tough guys like Canada thistle, field bindweed, crown vetch that are rhizomatous, and you have to smother them for 2 to 3 years to kill them. And then, of course, you have the option of constantly tilling the soil every 4 weeks and harassing the weeds until they die by ripping up their roots, which usually takes all summer, and you're out there tilling or plowing or whatever your equipment is for working on the ground. And if you're on a hillside, of course, you can't do this because then all of a sudden your soil is washing down the hill with every big rain. So you have to tailor the site preparation process to match your site, your soils, your values, whether you are willing to use herbicides or absolutely will abhor them and will not use them at all. So it's all very important to know what the weeds are and how you are going to eliminate them before seeding.
Do you ever do this as part of your role at Prairie Nursery? Will you provide that kind of service? Typically, people would do it themselves, I suppose. But I just wondered if you guys do that too.
You know, Larry, we used to have a big landscaping business back in the 90s and the 2000s, and then the recession of 2007 to 2009 basically wiped out that part of our business, and we never restarted it after the recovery. So, and it actually makes life a lot easier because we're back to our roots of growing plants and seeds and shipping them directly to our customers. But we did have a very sizable landscape operation 20 years ago, but not anymore. But there are lots and lots of companies that do this sort of work, and we work hand in glove with our customers to assist them through the process. You can go to our website at prairienursery.com, and it's loaded with information on the step-by-step process for gardens, for prairie meadows, from seeds, how to get the whole process started and then finished all the way through. So there's a lot of information on there. And then if customers have questions, they email us or call us, and we're more than happy to assist them.
Someone was wondering about transplanting prairie and woodland flowers. Can you do that in the fall?
Yes. Now, first and foremost, you have to make sure that the plant is transplantable. Most woodland plants, and when you look at woodland plants, you have flowers, you have woodland grasses, you have woodland sedges, which are similar to grasses, but they're in a different family, and then you have woodland ferns. These all tend to be fairly shallow-rooted species because the soils in woodlands, the better part of the soil, the most organic matter is usually in the top 6 to 8 inches of soil. So most of your woodland plants are not deep-rooted. And they're not under drought stress because they have the canopy of the tree, of the trees over them to prevent extreme heat conditions and sun conditions. So they don't have to go as deeply into the ground to be resilient during hot, dry periods. Whereas many of the prairie species have very deep roots. The grasses range anywhere from 1 foot to 8 feet deep, and then you have some flowers that have tap roots that can go 15 feet or deeper. So there, all the prairie grasses can be easily transplanted. If you only get the top half of the grass roots, you're okay usually. But okay. Tap rooted flowers like butterfly weed and pale purple cone flower and the baptisias, the false indigos, these and compass plant, these have very deep tap roots, and when people dig them up, they might get a foot, maybe 2 feet of the root, and that invariably that plant will not survive the transplant. So you have to know what plants you're transplanting. But yes, you can transplant them in the fall. You want to wait until the plants are dormant before you dig them, because if you dig an actively growing plant, then of course the plant is still requiring moisture from its roots, but you've disturbed the roots, and now the leaf, and you would of course cut them back immediately after digging them. But it's much more successful to wait until the plants are dormant, so there's no stress on the plant trying to supply moisture and nutrients to the growing part of the plant. So usually we do this in October into November. And most woodland plants are great transplanted in the fall. Most prairie plants will also transplant well, but you do want to take precautions to protect them over the winter. And we recommend that people cover them with a blanket of clean straw, like winter wheat straw. Yeah. And here's a really great technique. If you're transplanting plants, whether you grew the plants yourself or bought them or are moving them in your garden, when you put those plants in the fall, and we recommend if you're buying plants, plant them in mid to late September, early October. Let them grow, if they're still growing, and they usually grow, depending on the species, to the first frost or well beyond. And once they turn brown and go dormant, mark each plant with a little flag, with a little, you know, a little different colored plastic. Yeah. You have yellow ones and green ones and red ones. And you put a little label, put a code on it. So let's say if you're planting purple prairie clover, you could just say, you know, PPC or whatever your code is, and mark each plant before you put the straw down. And put that stake in that little flag. Get like at least 2 footers, 2 foot long ones, and put them in at least 6 inches so they don't heave out over the winter. Cover the whole area with 6 inches of clean straw, and now you have a winter blanket that protects those plants from the cold. And in the spring, just before they come up, usually early April, just pull back the straw a couple 3 inch diameter hole right where the flag is above the root crown so the plants can come up. And the straw now, the 6 inches has now gone down to 2 or 3 inches with the compression of snow over the winter. You have a perfect mulch which holds in moisture, reducing the need for watering, and prevents germination of weed seeds. So it has triple duty: protects your plants over the winter from cold, retains moisture, and keeps weeds down.
Very, very cool. Neil DeBoll, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist as well. Aubrey Ralph is our engineer today. Jane Rotunda, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Our guest is Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. And of course, we're talking about prairies. Questions for him, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Gene emailed, he wants to transplant a bergamot from prairie location to flower bed next spring. Should he choose a plant with maybe 3 stems or on the center portion of a much larger plant? How deep should he dig?
Well, bergamot is pretty bulletproof, so it's hard to kill. But you can do it if you do it wrong, but it's pretty hard to kill. So you can plant bergamot either in the fall, when you can still identify it by the stems and leaves. In the fall, I mean like October, after it starts to go dormant. Or you can do it next spring. If you're going to transplant it next spring, you need to mark the plant so you can find it, because the vegetation will likely crumble or it may not be a sufficient residual material in order to locate it. So if you pick out the plant that you want to transplant, mark it, and again, you can just use a flag and stick the flag in, you know, at least 6 inches into the ground. And then the next spring, before the plant starts to send up new leaves, or just as it's beginning to, you can just chop a chunk off, because bergamot creeps by rhizomes to form a patch. And you can take a chunk about 6 inches in diameter out of the middle of that, or the side of that plant, and lift that out, and you only have to go about 4 or 5 inches deep. You can go 6 inches just to be sure, but the roots are fairly shallow. And just take that chunk and put it to its new home and firm it well into the soil and water it down, and you should have great results.
All right. Well, Karen in La Crosse emailed, can you talk about harvesting prairie seeds, including information on how to store the seeds you save? She planted a prairie area around her home, and it has delighted them every day, but she's moving to Atlanta. Suggestions on learning what type of prairie plants would be best in a climate like Atlanta's.
Okay, so we have two questions here. One is how to collect prairie seeds, and the other is what prairie plants would grow well in Atlanta. Is that correct, Larry?
That is right.
Okay, great. So collecting seed is just basic intuition. And if you observe plants through their life cycle, they go from flower to seed, but there's many, many intergradations as the seeds are forming and ripening and then dropping. So you want to check the plants regularly and check their seed heads. Most plants, when the seed is ripe, it comes easily from the seed receptacle where it is stored. Now, seeds come in all different, they're formed in all different sorts of structures. So, but if the seed falls out of the pods, or the pods break open and you have full, firm, plump seeds, then you know that they're ripe. If you have, let's take a yellow coneflower, for instance. It has little black seeds arranged all the way around a cone. If those are in purple coneflower, the same. If those seeds come out easily when you take your hand to it or thumb to it and crush it, do the seeds dislodge readily? Then those seeds are ripe. If you have to pull at them to get them off, then they're almost certainly not ripe. But every species is different. And some, but when you think they're ripe, they're not ripe, and some, when you think they're ripe, they've already dropped. And I'll give you some examples. Anybody that's ever collected Ohio spiderwort seed, if you go out when the seed pods are brown, the seeds are long gone, and there's nothing left. You have to collect them when the pods are green to greenish blue, and maybe one flower is still opening. And a spiderwort, Ohio spiderwort, the flowers only open in the morning unless it's a cloudy afternoon. So you want to collect seeds from pods that are closed, but maybe one flower left, okay? And you can see the little black seeds, they'll be brownish to black. They're ripe. And when you're collecting them, this plant has a lot of mucilaginous material. We call it snotweed because it gets all over your hands when you collect it, and your hands turn blue. So it's all very exciting. Don't touch your clothes. So that's an exceptional one where you actually have to collect the seed before it begins to dry out. If you're collecting wild lupine, which grows on dry sandy soils in central Wisconsin, these seed pods explode, and you have to get to them before they blow up, which is usually the last week of June and the first week of July, depending on the year. And when the pods are turning yellow, that's the time to get them. But sometimes you got to be Johnny on the spot, and you got to go out every day. The trick with lupine is when the seeds are ripe, you hit the pods with the back of your hand, and if you can hear a rattle, they're ripe. Even if the pods are green, if you can hear them rattle, they're ripe. So every seed has its own ripening. You have to really know each plant personally in order to really get to know it. There are books on this. Okay, so there are books out there on collecting, harvesting, drying, and storing your seeds. But the vast majority of prairie seeds, in fact, practically all, you have to dry them down. And once they're dry, you can put them in plastic bags or Ziploc bags and put them in the refrigerator, and many of them will keep for many years. And each species will keep for different periods of time. The grasses, generally 3 to 4 years, will retain good viability. The silphiums, like compass plant and prairie duck and rosin weed and cup plant, these will keep 5 to 10 years. In fact, studies that I did showed that seeds that were 5 years old, I tested them 5 years later after they'd been harvested, and their germination rates in many cases were higher than after 1 year.
Wow.
So there is sometimes after ripening that will actually increase the germination if the seeds are stored properly. So you have to collect them at the right time, dry them, and then make sure that you've got a proper storage location, cool and dry. If you leave seeds at room temperature, they will rapidly decline because seeds respire, and the enemy of seeds are moisture and heat. So you want a cool, dry location, preferably a refrigerator, in a Ziploc bag with dry seeds. However, there are woodland plants that have to be kept moist or they lose viability, like trillium seeds and twin leaf and bloodroot. If they dry out, they go into deep dormancy, and they're much more difficult to germinate. So normally with woodland seeds, you're best off to direct sow them immediately upon collection and just get them into the ground and let nature take its course.
And in terms of Atlanta, I know anything about what works there?
Well, I would check with the local native plant society in Georgia and see what folks say there. But I will tell you, here's a great way. If you're a hardcore plant nerd, here's one of the greatest things in the world is this website called the Biota of North America Project, www.bonap. It is loaded with information, and if you want to find out where a plant is native, the range, you go to this site, and then on the left-hand side, it will say plants by genus. You got to know your scientific names. Okay, so this is not for everybody. But you can go in plants by genus, and it lists all the genera of every plant, every higher green plant. And you can click on the genus, and then it will bring up all the species with maps by county. And you can see the county in which that plant has been documented to occur either by herbarium records or surveys. And it is a phenomenal resource if you want to find out where plants are, what region plants are native to. And you can bore right down to your own county if you want. It's an amazing, amazing resource.
And it's B-O-N-A-P,
Bonap.
A-P.
Yep, www.bonap.org, O-R-G.
.org, okay. Well, let's go to Todd in De Pere. Todd, what's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I have two ponds, and they each have a dike of clay. And I've been preparing them for the last couple of years. One of the dikes can get completely covered with water in the early spring snow melt. I was thinking of lightly tilling each dike, mixing oat seed with the forbs seeds, and then putting in a lightly tilled, rolling it. Does that sound like a correct procedure?
You say forbs seed. Are you not going to use any grasses?
I'm not planning on any grasses. I'm trying to. I'm gearing towards pollinating pollinators, so I'm thinking flowers mostly.
Okay, I would caution you that if you do not include any prairie grasses, you will get whatever grasses nature gives you because you're leaving an ecological niche wide open, and Mother Nature's going to fill that niche because you know she abhors a vacuum. Which means you will probably get quackgrass and bluegrass and other species that you might not want in your planting because it will not stay open for long. So normally what we do with our pollinator mixes is we use an even balance of grasses and flowers, of native prairie grasses and flowers, and we get excellent results with that. So I would be very cautious not including some amount of grass in there. The oats is a great idea. You're talking about seeding this soon. Is that correct, Todd? This fall?
I'm looking for your opinion on when I should actually do this then and seed it.
Okay. Yeah, if your main goal is flowers, then you would definitely want to seed in the fall to optimize germination. But you're absolutely right. You want to stabilize that soil, and oats is definitely the way to go. Is this hard packed clay at this point?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Is it like really gumbo clay and sticks together and forms bricks, or is it a little better than that?
It's a little bit better than that. It spoils, of course, when they made the wildlife ponds. I'm in the deep here area, so it's, you know,
red clay.
Pretty heavy clay.
Red clay. Yep, it's Kiwani silt loam. And it's red, right?
Yes.
Yep, I know that soil. I've worked on it many times. Yeah, that's really tough stuff. And is there no topsoil in it? Is it the subsoil that they dug out of the hole?
It's the subsoil. I suspect, unfortunately, I was out of town when they did it. I suspect they just put the spoils, unfortunately, on top of the topsoil where they, when they made the pond. I don't know if they,
yeah.
I think
okay.
that's what they did.
Okay. Well, I actually did an experiment when I managed the Arboretum at UW-Green Bay back when dinosaurs roamed the earth many years ago. And we dug a pond, and we had that red subsoil clay. And I took 50 different species of prairie plants and seeded them on this red spoils. And on one half, I covered it with straw, and the other half, I just left the clay open. The side with no straw had very low germination. Very few species showed up. The side with the straw cover, I got really reasonably good germination with not only higher density of the prairie flowers and grasses, but more diversity. So first and foremost, when you're dealing with a subsoil clay environment, you have to provide it with some sort of mulch to retain moisture, because once that clay dries out, the seedlings cannot penetrate that tight clay. So you have to have a way to maintain soil moisture in that clay. And the best way to do that is with a layer of chopped and blown straw that won't blow away, or with a straw mat that you roll out and stake into the ground. The straw mat is more reliable because, again, it doesn't blow away. So if you're working on that clay, no matter what you seed, you want to put down a straw mat. Also, make sure that that straw mat, if you look at the top, it has a plastic mesh. Make sure those openings are no smaller than 3/4 inch by 3/4 inch, because the larger prairie flower seedlings that have to arch their back or crane their neck to come up through that mat will get stuck in a tighter mesh and they will not emerge properly. So a 3/4 by 3/4 inch opening on the plastic mesh on the top is critical. A straw mat, you can use an Excelsior mat as well, like a Curlex mat, but it doesn't quite give you the same water holding capacity as the straw. So the straw is better on a heavy clay. And then you plant in the fall, you put down your straw mat, include the oats, because the oats will help stabilize the soil and hold the mat in place as well as the stakes. And then the seed will germinate the following spring. And oats is the perfect nurse crop because it will not survive the winter and it will not compete with your planting the next year. If you put in winter wheat or winter rye, those are designed, or by nature, they will survive the winter and come back to compete with your planting. And I've seen disasters where people have used winter rye or winter wheat instead of oats as their fall nurse crop or cover crop, and it comes up, the wheat or the rye comes up the next year and smothers everything and the planting is ruined. So it's very important that you use the oats. Yeah, this is super. They seem like minor details, but they are huge, huge factors. Also, winter rye is allelopathic, meaning that it produces chemicals. Oh. And it uses chemical warfare to prevent the germination of other species. And that is why when you see a winter rye field the next spring, there's not a weed in there. How did it happen? It wasn't herbicides. Well, it was herbicides, but it was naturally produced herbicides, chemical warfare produced by the winter rye. Winter wheat is somewhat allelopathic and does the same, but not to the same degree. And oats is completely non-allelopathic, so it will not harm or interfere with the germination, nor will it come back the next spring.
Todd, there you go.
Shallow tilling?
Yeah, it's a very good question. You don't want to till very deep, okay? Just till up that surface inch of soil to get a decent seed bed, okay? And then scatter your seed and rake it in lightly, roll it, and then put down your straw blanket and stake it in.
Okay, thank you very much.
I know. If you want, Todd, if you want, we do have a seed mix, if this is of interest to you. We have a seed mix called our Clay Busters mix, which was developed from my experiments on the very soils that you are working with. We also have a mix called our pollinator mix when I say clay buster mix, that is our tall prairie for medium to clay soils. That is a specific name, tall prairie for medium to clay soils, which is ideal for growing on your soil. The number of flowers is not as diverse as in our pollinator habitat mix. We have a pollinator habitat mix for medium soils, and the vast majority of those species would be expected to do well on your clay as long as you put down that erosion blanket. And finally, for optimal results, if you can water this every 3 days when it's not raining for the first 3 months, okay, which would be basically April 15th through July 15th, or even if you just go from the months of May and June, if you can water this every few days, you will see tremendous improvement in germination in the first growing season. So you plant it this fall, put down your straw mat, put down your oats mix with the seed before you put down the mat, and then start watering May 1st through June 30th of next year, and you'll have really good results.
Okay. Good luck, Todd. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Great advice. For sure there, Neil. Mike in Oshkosh has a question or comment. Mike, hello.
Hi, hello. I'm interested in putting in some purple coneflower in my backyard. It's a very large garden. It already has goldenrod and milkweed in it, and I'm looking to attract monarchs. Should I go from seed to get the coneflower in there, and do I need to peel back the bark mulch and leave that exposed while the seeds are germinating?
Okay, let me ask you a few questions, okay?
Sure.
Okay, so what's your time frame? When do you want to see flowers?
Whatever is most beneficial, I think fall.
Okay, I mean, how long do you want to wait? Because if you use seeds, it's usually 2 to 3 years before they bloom, more likely 3 than 2. And if you put in transplants, say you put in plants this fall or next spring, they should bloom the year that they're in, this next coming summer. So it's instant results with plants usually, or probably a 3-year wait from seeds. So that's your first question. Of course, seeds are much cheaper than plants, but you're trading time for money. Okay. If you decide to go with seeds, you absolutely have to peel back the mulch and put the seed about a half an inch deep in the mineral soil. If you put it in a mulch, the chances of germination and growth are pretty low because mulch is specifically designed not to allow anything to grow because it has a very high carbon-nitrogen ratio, and nitrogen and other nutrients are generally unavailable, so very few things can grow in it. So if you want to seed something, you have to get down into the native mineral soil, either whether you're putting in transplants or putting in seeds. And if you're putting in seeds, it's a flower, so put it in the fall, and you'll get better germination than if you plant it in seed in spring. Purple coneflower is able to germinate pretty well when seeded in May or June, but it will do better if seeded in the fall.
All right.
One more question here. If I get a transplant, how do I source that? My local prairie nursery? I just want a small concentration of coneflower. And what is most beneficial for monarchs?
Sure. Well, we sell purple coneflower. You can buy it from a mail order nursery such as ourselves, mail order internet nursery, or you can go to your local nursery. One of the things you want to be, this is a really interesting question that you bring up here. Purple coneflower has been bred and hybridized. So there is this tremendous variety of what is often called a nativar, which are cultivars or hybrids of native species. And there's a big discussion on whether these are good, bad, or ecologically good or negative for a variety of reasons. And we could spend some time on this if Larry wants to, but basically you're messing with Mother Nature, which people love to do anyway, so it's, you're not going to stop this even if you wanted to. But what has occurred here is that many of the hybrids, cultivars, et cetera, are selected for their flower colors and length of bloom, size of flower, but many of them have proven not to be very cold tolerant and sometimes drought tolerant. So they seem to have lost some of the vigor of the native species. So not all, but many have been documented to show that. We grow only open pollinated plants at Prairie Nursery, i.e. the wild type. We don't monkey around with the nativars, cultivars, et cetera, because that's not our mission. Our mission is to preserve genetic diversity rather than narrow it in selecting specific nativars or hybrids. So it does depend upon what kind of garden you want. And also, one other thing that's been shown is that some nativars have very poor nectar and pollen characteristics for the very animals and critters that you want to attract. So this is not to say that they could not be bred for higher levels of pollen, higher levels of nectar, but there are many that have been proven to have much lower decreased levels. So generally speaking, you're probably safer using the original native wild types to ensure that you know that you're going to get the kind of attraction for the critters you want. And if you're looking for butterflies, there are many other genera that you could look at, including the blazing stars, Liatris, and the Joe Pieweeds, Eutrochium. They used to be Eupatoriums, now they're Eutrochiums. Who knows what they'll be next week. When the common name becomes more reliable than the scientific name, that's when you know you got a problem with your religion. So, yep, the Pharisees have gotten hold of the scientific names, and they're counting how many angels are on the head to the pin, and good luck with that whole program. So the other genera that you could look at are Asclepias, and if you're looking at monarchs in particular, you will need Asclepias, i.e. the milkweeds, because those are the larval host plants that the caterpillars depend upon, and depending upon your soil type, there's a Asclepias for every soil. For instance, if you have a heavy clay soil, you can work with the common milkweed or the red milkweed or marsh milkweed. And if you have a dry, sandy soil, you can work with the butterfly weed or the whorled milkweed, W-H-O-R-L-E-D, which forms beautiful patches. It's in full bloom right now. It's absolutely stunning. And for medium soils, you also can use Sullivan's milkweed, which is a little trickier, a little more specific. But the main milkweeds that we see in Wisconsin are the common milkweed, which creeps by rhizomes to form patches. So if you have a small garden, do not plant this plant. Or the red milkweed, which forms individual plants. And it is the one of the preferred food sources. The leaves of the red milkweed or the marsh milkweed are preferred by the monarch caterpillars. And then for dry sandy soils, butterfly weed with its beautiful orange flowers and whorled milkweed with its bright white flowers.
Mike, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jan in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Jan. Jan, are you there? Maybe we lost Jan. Well, how about Marilyn in Ellison? Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning, Neil. We have a prairie at our homeowners association that was established 20 years ago with Prairie Nursery Seed. And I've been involved recently in just trying to keep the bad boys out of there. We're dealing with bladder cambion, Queen Anne's lace, white sweet clover, knapweed, and we're pulling and doing that sort of thing, but it's getting a little overwhelming. I know that fire is probably the preferred method of working with this problem, but we have homes that are too close to the periphery and nervous homeowners, so it's not exactly available to us. I'm wondering, there's something I'm going to call a flamethrower that has been used for specific plants to create a bit of fire to just go individually. Do you have any experience with that, and is that something that might be considered?
You can do this, but it's what you're doing there is something very different from a prairie burn. So you're using these flamethrowers during the growing season, correct? You would be? Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Whereas a prairie burn is usually done either in the fall or the spring. And so it's very rare that you would ever burn a prairie during the growing season, such as you're proposing for burning individual plants. So it's very different from a normal prescribed burn. That's not to say that you cannot use these for killing plants, but there will be significant. Or the other thing is that you will not, if it's a perennial, like a bladder cambion, you're probably not going to kill the plant. You're just going to burn back the vegetation because you have to go down deep into the soil in order to kill the root. And then there will almost undoubtedly be collateral damage to the desirable prairie plants nearby. So let's look at each of your species strategically. Your problems are sweet clover, a biennial, and Queen Anne's lace, a biennial, and bladder cambion, a short-lived perennial. And what was the third one? A fourth one?
Spotted knapweed.
Spotted knapweed. Okay, another short-lived perennial. Let's deal with the biennials first. So sweet clover and Queen Anne's lace. The best way to handle them is because they're biennials, they rely upon self-sowing by producing seeds in their second year. So the first year they form basal rosettes of leaves, and the second year they bloom, make seed, and die. So you have to break the cycle of seed formation. So how do we do that efficiently? Are you going to go out there and like pull every plant? Oh, too much work. Okay. So what you can do, and well, actually in my prairie, I have, you know, a couple acres of prairie. I actually go out and pull these, but I've been doing it for 30 years and I have just a few plants, you know, and I have a zero tolerance policy and I'm still pulling those doggone things. Here's how stupid Neil is. Yeah. Okay. 1 year in my prairie, 25 years ago, I had one Queen Anne's lace. I said, oh, isn't that cute? Love that plant. Yeah, I know it's bad, but how much damage could one Queen Anne's lace do? I am still pulling that thing out because it made seeds. 25 years later, I'm pulling the progeny from that damn Queen Anne's lace. These seeds can remain viable in the soil for decades, and they will come back to haunt you. And so there was obviously sweet clover growing in these. These were woodlands that I cut down. 40-year-old box elders and buckthorns, cut it all down, killed it for 2 years, put down my prairie seed, and it grew up to solid sweet clover from dormant seeds. There were no sweet clovers growing in that woods, believe me, not a one. I'm still pulling it 30 years after I seeded it. I have a zero tolerance policy. I'm pulling every single one. But on a larger scale, you probably don't have time to pull. So what you do, and this is how this works for sweet clover, this works for burdock, this works for wild parsnip, this works for garlic mustard. It works for practically every biennial, with the exception of Queen Anne's Lace, but we'll get to that later. Okay. The biennials, once they have finished flowering, if they are determinant flowers, meaning that all the flowers pretty much flower at the same time, once they have finished flowering, you cut their little heads off and cut the seed heads off. You can do it with a mower, you can do it with a weed whacker, you can do it with a pruning shears. Cut their heads off. And you do not have to remove them from the site because they just finished flowering and the seeds have not yet formed. But if you cut the biennial's seed heads off after they bloom, the plant will die and the seeds will not form. No need. And I see people out pulling garlic mustard and bagging it up. I'm going, my God, what a waste. What a waste. What a waste. All you have to do is go out with a weed whip or a weed whacker right after the garlic mustard seeds have finished blooming. You whip their little heads off. You come back 2 weeks later, and all the garlic mustard plants are melted away like the Wicked Witch of the West. Oh, my precious beauty. Oh, what a world, what a world. Gone. And the seeds will not mature. So this is what you do with the sweet clover. This is what you do with the other biennial weeds. Queen Anne's Lace, unfortunately, is an indeterminate flowering plant. So even if you whack it when the flowers of some of them are done, there's still others that are coming. So this is a little trickier one. The Queen Anne's Lace would be one that you would want to pull out by the roots after a rain if possible. So a little bit more difficult to deal with. But the others, the sweet clovers, the burdocks, the wild parsnips, you can just whack their heads off right after they finish blooming and you're done with it. No need to remove it. No need to worry about them coming back.
There we go. Mm-hmm. Neil DeBoll, our guest, by the way, president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist as well. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Talking Prairies today with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Appreciate your listening and appreciate your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also email us to ideas@wpr.org. Neil, did you get the information out you needed for our last caller? I think you did.
Pretty much. I mean, we could talk about the intricacies of these situations, but the one thing we did not deal with was the spotted knapweed nor the bladder campion. So these are generally short-lived perennials, and the bladder campion is usually not a real serious threat. It's really hard to eliminate completely, but it doesn't really compete terribly with most of your prairie flowers and grasses unless you've got a really bad infestation. The spotted knapweed, on the other hand, is a real bear, and it's really tough to control. And a lot of people are reduced to going out and spot spraying it with herbicides because when you pull it, the roots break off easily, so a lot of your time is wasted if you can't extract the entire root. So, and there are broadleaf herbicides that you can use to kill spotted knapweed, but you have to be super careful because you can do collateral damage to your other flowers in the prairie. So we generally do not recommend going in and spot spraying because there's just too much damage, potential for damaging those plants. The other choice is just to go in there with a weed whacker. And when the plants are just in bloom, past bloom, and because it's a perennial, you don't have the same sort of a situation where you wait until the flowers are done and whack it down. But you can do something similar and just whack it back. But you're probably going to have to do it twice or maybe three times during the growing season because they will rebloom. So it's really, really hard to control spotted knapweed. If you are going to use an herbicide, you can use aminopyrrolid, also known as milestone, or a close relative called clopyrrolid, which is generally sold as Stinger or Lontrell. But be careful, these will kill your prairie flowers. Okay. And some people use 2,4-D ester, but I'm not a big fan of 2,4-D because it's in a class of compounds that I would never touch with a 10-foot pole. I used it once, and that was it. Never again. So I tend to use the aminopyrrolid and clopyrrolid because aminopyrrolid was the first broadleaf herbicide that was given the EPA's designation of reduced-risk broadleaf herbicide. So if you read the toxicology reports, it's in a whole different class by itself. So I will use that, but I won't use 2,4-D.
Terry in Melrose has a question. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a question. We have a very large lot here and everything, and it's surrounded on two sides with woods. Now, part of our land there, probably an area about 25 by 40, is clear, and the grass grows there, and the weeds grow there, but my wife would kind of like that to become a prairie garden. The problem, as I see it, is that it's a lot of shade. There is some light that does come into it, but it does have a lot of shade. Is it possible to have a prairie garden in a situation like that?
Let me ask you a couple questions, okay?
Okay.
What is your soil type? Is it sand, clay, loam?
It's a sandy loam.
Sandy loam, okay. This is an interesting question because if you look at where plants will grow, it is generally an interaction of the soil type, the soil moisture, and the light conditions. General rule of thumb is if you want to have success with prairie flowers and grasses, you need at least a half a day of direct sun per day. A half a day. So if you get all day morning sun until 1 o'clock, that's good. Or if you get all the afternoon sun from 1 o'clock on, that's good too. If you have less than that, it's not going to work so well. That said, there are many prairie flowers and grasses, mostly the flowers, that are shade tolerant and will grow well in less than a half a day of full sun, but your grasses will tend not to do well. So if your goal is to have prairie grasses mixed with your flowers, if you have less than a half a day of full sun, that's going to be a little trickier. Now, there are native sedges that you can use instead of prairie grasses for semi-shaded situations, and that's a very good solution. The native sedges usually are more expensive than the prairie grasses, usually about, 5 to 10 times more expensive in terms of cost per pound. So it will be a higher cost type of planting. The interesting interactions here between soils, moisture, and sun is that if you have a semi-shaded, dry, sandy soil, many of your prairie savanna plants will grow in that drier soil than if it were a clay soil. So if you look at what I call our oak barrens or our savannas on dry sandy soils, you'll see a lot of prairie plants that will actually grow in the filtered shade on those drier soils. If that soil were clay, they would not do well there. So in your sandy loam, I would still go with a half a day of full sun in order for you to have really good results with a prairie.
Well, thank you. I think what I got to do is really study that and keep track of how much shade it actually does have. I know there's time it does have sun there, but I don't know how much. So
That's exactly the way to approach this. And look at it. And this is really interesting. If you want to get an idea of the sun conditions, you would look at what the sun conditions are right around August 1st, because that is the intermediate between August 1st, just a couple weeks ago. That's the intermediate between June 21st and September 21st. Okay, so that's between the maximum sun in the summer and the equinox in September. So that's a really good time to gauge how much sun you're getting.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, if you want a prairie and you got some trees, as my first boss said, you know, Neil, you can solve a lot of landscape problems with a chainsaw.
Okay.
Very much so. I know there's trees that probably don't need to be there either, so you're right.
Okay.
Well, good luck. Hope that helps.
Thanks a lot for calling. Let's see if we got time for a quick one here. Mike in La Crosse emailed. He has a lot of prairie blazing star coming up on his lawn. He wants them there, but he doesn't want the grass. If he covers the area with cardboard right now, it should kill the grass, but because the atras have a bulb, will they be able to survive?
You know, this is an interesting question. I've never been asked this. This is fascinating. I don't know. I don't know. But I think the premise is sound, because those blazing stars can go dormant, and they can go dormant for extended periods of time. So I bet you if he covered that, when he says grass, I assume that's bluegrass, regular Kentucky bluegrass?
Probably.
Okay. I bet this would work if he smothered it now and then kept it smothered until probably late May of next year, because the maximum growing, the optimal growing time for cool season grasses is late August through November, and then mid-April through June. But you want to get those blazing stars uncovered so they can come up. But I bet if he covered it now and left it there until probably could get away with June 1 and then lift it up and probably that grass will be dead. And the blazing stars, I bet, will then emerge after that. There's only one problem, as we talked about earlier in the show. You kill the grass, Mother Nature's going to fill that with something else. And the blazing stars do not exist in a vacuum, and you're going to get weeds galore in there, and you probably will be unhappy with the final results. This, as brilliant as this strategy is, you may rue the day that you implemented it. So be careful out there. Be careful.
Neil DeBole, our guest, president of Prairie Nursery, and also a consulting ecologist. He works really sometimes around the world consulting with folks. So it's always great to have him here. I'm Larry Mealer for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Talking about prairie plantings on Garden Talk today, Larry Mealer here with Neil DeBole back with us. He's the president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist as well. So what questions do you have about prairie plantings? Are you looking for some plant recommendations, for example? What kinds of problems do you have? I hope you'll join in the conversation with us. We had an email from a listener who wondered if senna seeds are difficult to germinate. They've had ended up with a large amount of seed from one huge plant and have tossed the seeds into existing prairies over the years with very little success at this point. They have tried to germinate in flats with no success either.
Well, senna seeds are not particularly difficult to germinate. As we talked about earlier, you have dormancy breaking requirements for many species, and for senna seeds and most legumes, you can simply pre-treat them with a cold, damp treatment for 30 days and normally see excellent germination rates. So what we do is you can either sow them directly into the flats and then cover the flats with saran wrap to retain moisture, and then put them in a refrigerator or a walk-in cooler. We have a giant walk-in cooler where we put our flats. And then take them out after 30 days, and you should start to see germination within 7 to 10 days. If you don't pre-treat them, the germination rate will be lower, but not necessarily non-existent. So I don't know what's going on when they're growing them in flats. But if they pre-treat them with the 30 days of cold, damp treatment, they should see excellent results. Throwing seeds into an existing prairie sod is basically an exercise in futility for the most part. Reason being, when you're dealing with trying to establish new species in a fully established grassland sod, you have to think like an attorney. Possession is 9/10 of the law. And the existing grasses and flowers are not going to give up their space readily. So when you throw all that seed in there, it's got to find a spot of open soil where it can germinate and grow. And even if it does germinate, it has to compete with already established perennial plants. A very, very tall order and difficult task. So generally speaking, the efficacy of tossing seeds into an established grassland, whether it's a prairie or an old field that's grown up to grasses and weeds, generally your results will be very, very low. And this is why we make sure to eliminate all the existing vegetation before we put any seeds down. Because if we don't, we're going to get very poor results.
Bill in Superior has a question. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I don't have any prairie issues. My main problem is I got a huge issue with poison ivy on my property. I have bought some herbicides and sprayed a little bit, but I have acres of poison ivy. And I read somewhere about a cheaper remedy that I can use with a salt water and dish soap mixture. I'm just wondering, you know, I could produce that on mass quantity to kill all of it. My question is that feasible, and how much of the surrounding foliage around the poison ivy is it going to kill in turn?
OK, Okay, is this poison ivy in an open sunny field, or is it in a wooded situation? What is the actual growing condition?
It's more in a wooded situation.
Okay, you're going to have a really difficult row to hoe here, and I have never used the salt and dish soap approach, so I really don't know. Maybe Larry can provide some insight on that. He has such a wide variety of experience. I don't know, Larry, do you have any idea on this?
I don't, but I, you know, if you're putting a lot of salt into the soil, I don't know that that's a good idea.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, again, it seems kind of dicey to me, so because you can really mess up the sodium balance if you put too much on. I don't know what the rates would be, so it may not be that big a deal. But here's the issue when you're dealing with invasive plants, particularly invasive woody plants. And of course, poison ivy is a woody vine. And this is why restoration in woodlands is so much more difficult than restorations in prairies in open sunny areas, and that's because of the tree canopy. So the tree canopy wonderfully supports populations of birds. But what do birds do when they're sitting in a tree? They had buckthorn or honeysuckle or poison ivy seeds for lunch, and they're taking their nap up there and pooping out all those seeds right into your woods. And so it is a never-ending battle against the invasive woody plants that the birds will deliver to your site. Even if you eliminate everything, you go out there and spray it or whatever you're doing, you can get rid of everything, but the birds are just going to bring it back in. So it's an extra added level of difficulty because of the dynamic of importing these seeds. And birds love poison ivy seeds. They gobble them up, fly around, and deposit them right where you don't want them. So you're going to have a never-ending battle. And once again, like I said, you can solve a lot of landscape problems with a chainsaw. So, but that may not be what you want to do here. But you have to tailor your expectations to fit the reality of your situation and how much work you're going to put into it to maintain it.
Yeah, there you go, Bill. Thank you for calling. Kel in Sugar Camp, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I had two questions. I've got some lovely Turk's cap lilies. They go like about 5-6 feet, and they have little bulbs along their stems. I never see any seed cases. How soon do I have to plant those bulblets before they are no longer viable?
Now you say you have bulblets along the stems.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not a Turk's cap lily.
Okay.
Okay, that's a tiger lily. Okay. So it's a totally different species. It's a non-native species, and you have these little bulblets, which you can break off and stick them in the ground, and they will grow. If you want more of them, but that's not actually the Turk's cap lily. And a Turk's cap lily grows in rich, moist soils, and I'm guessing this lily that you've got is growing in just a regular garden soil. Is that correct?
I think we may have lost.
Okay. Yeah, you'll see the tiger lily has these little bulblets that are produced on the stem, and they're vegetative reproductive structures, and you can just break off and plant them. The one thing you want to be careful with is that tiger lily is an alternate host for viruses that can attack your native lilies. So generally, and they are unaffected, but they can be carriers, and then you can have your native lilies becoming infected with viral infections that the tiger lilies carry that do not affect them but will harm your native lilies. So I'm not generally a big fan. I mean, tiger lilies, it's a beautiful plant, but it does have its potential drawbacks if you're trying to establish native lilies nearby.
Joey in Monroe, she had some success starting sweetgrass from seed last year wintered over the plants with good success. She now has 18 3-inch pots she'd like to transplant into a wet mesic prairie she started last fall. Sweetgrass is supposed to spread easily, perhaps even somewhat aggressively. How would she plant these into her new wet mesic prairie? Would she keep them planted together in one spot or in a small lots of several plants scattered around the prairie? The prairie is not very large, 90 by 60 feet.
Okay, I guess it depends on what she wants the plants to do, and is she looking at growing them for sweetgrass braids where she would harvest the leaves and braid them? So if you're going to do that, you want to have less competition from adjacent plants in order to maximize the production of the sweetgrass. So in that case, you would almost not necessarily want to put it into the prairie itself, but maybe even almost garden it in a garden situation. Sweetgrass creeps by rhizomes, and it can just send these little runners that kind of work their way in among the other plants. So so it kind of can be this little, almost this little sneak stealth plant that creeps around with these individual or small rhizomes. So it really depends on what she wants them to do, how she wants them to grow, how much she wants to produce. If they're in direct competition with other plants, then their total production is going to be reduced just because of that competition for nutrients and water. So if she wants braids, if she wants leaves for braids, I would make sure they have their own place where they can produce lots and lots of leaves for her to use. I hope that answers the question for her.
Ted in Ashland, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Ted.
Hey, hi. How are you guys doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Well, thanks. I love all this information. This doesn't have anything to do in particular with native plants. However, I heard you guys talking about weed whippers, and this is a little bit off the track, but I had a weed whipper like an awful lot of people do, and I'm whipping around something, cleaning junk up here in Ashland, and it dawned on me, why do I have to keep replacing the weed whipper coil all the time? What happens to all that stuff? And then I realized, oh, my God, all I'm doing is littering the ground that I'm working so hard to take care of with little tiny bits of plastic cord. And that about made my head explode. But I dunked it in some water real fast in a rain barrel and cooled down. And I set that thing down, and I haven't used it since. And I've gone back to the old hand clipping ways, which I do understand is not necessarily viable for everybody in all situations. I just wanted to bring that up so your listeners could realize that, you know, you in fact are leaving little tiny chunks of plastic everywhere that you use those things.
Okay.
That's a very, very good point. And when I use the term weed whip, that is a hand tool. And it is the old-fashioned weed whip with just a blade on it. It's about a 12-inch blade, 9 to 12-inch blade.
Good.
And you use it by hand. And I have that, and I have another one that's more heavy-duty that has like a triangular support piece on it. I do not own a weed whacker. A weed whacker is a great machine, but as you point out, that plastic is littered all over the place. That is why I use a weed whip. And when I'm controlling the garlic mustard or the sweet clover in my prairie, when I'm chopping them back, I go out on a Sunday afternoon or whenever, Sunday morning, which is the only time I have, and I take my little weed whip and go whack, 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 and cut those little suckers' heads off. So I do not use a weed whacker. And I think you bring up a really, really good point. And I wonder, if you were to collect all the plastic that is strewn about just the United States of America with a weed whacker every year, how many miles of plastic string, how many times across the country could you stretch that?
Probably a lot.
Around the world, yeah, that's right. Good point, Ted. Absolutely great point.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Lois in Algoma will give you a shot. Hi, Aunt Lois.
Thank you. I am so enjoying this program. I've been waiting, hoping someone might ask my question. I have a beautiful milkweed garden, started with one milkweed in the lawn, and now I have yellow coneflowers that are so aggressive, I need to remove some of them. I did do a control burn this past spring, and I also have many perennial flowers mixed in with the common milkweed, including aster that I planted. Could you tell me, please, how I can remove some of the yellow coneflower?
Okay. You have basically two ways. It's all mixed together with the rest of your plants, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Basically, you've got two options. One is to go in there and dig them out individually by the roots, which is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And the other is when the yellow cone flowers are coming up usually around mid-June, you can go out and if you're okay with using herbicides, you can spot spray them, being very careful not to kill anything else with the herbicide. And one time, one shot is probably not going to do it. They'll probably resprout and you'll have to come back later in the year and do it another time. And here's a little trick on how to prevent drift from your sprayer nozzle onto adjacent desirable plants. You can take a plastic soda can, cut the bottom half off, so you just have the top where the lid goes on, and then take off the nozzle on the sprayer and slip the soda can so that the top is up and the half of the soda can is down, and duct tape it onto the nozzle, and then put onto the wand, and then put the nozzle back on. Actually, it's easier to put the nozzle back on while the bottle is loose, so you can push it back up, and then have about a 2-inch height of the, or 3-inch height, depending upon what you're spraying, above the ground. So you have a 3-inch height on that clear plastic soda bottle. And then you can go out and just put that over the target plant, like the yellow coneflower, and then you can just hit it once with your sprayer and just get it on the leaves of that plant so it doesn't go sideways onto adjacent plants.
Good point.
So you can dig it out, or you can spray it. That's really the only two options that you have, unless somebody else has a magic bullet that I'm unaware of.
Okay. Lois, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jan in Madison, wonders if you can dehydrate seeds in a dehydrator.
I don't know. I suppose you could. You'd want to be very careful that the temperature was not excessive, because generally what happens if temperatures go above about 130, 140 degrees, you can denature proteins, which can destroy the seeds. So you want to be super careful as far as the temperatures that you expose the seeds to. I'm sure you can, because when we dry seed, you know, we just blow forced air on them, but we don't heat it. But you want to be super careful that you don't overheat it and kill the seed itself.
Doug in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Another great show. Say, you said for getting rid of Queen Anne's lace, you can pull the plants when they're flowering before they go to seed. But we missed the part of your advice about whether or not you then have to remove the thing from the property, or can you just pull it before it goes to seed and leave it in place?
This is a really good question, Doug. And Queen Anne's lace is a real bear. It's a real quandary, because it is an indeterminate flowering plant, and so it blooms for an extended period of time. And so you'll have seeds that are from the early flowers that are forming and maturing while the plant is still in bloom. So you're waiting until the plant finishes blooming to whack it, but meanwhile, the early flowers are maturing and producing viable seeds. So you have to, if you're going to whack it, you have to whack it before those early flowers form viable seed, which doesn't kill the plant, because it will come back and rebloom only at a lower level, and you have to whack it at a lower level, and they're harder to find. It is a real, real challenge. So if the seeds,
property?
I'm sorry?
If you
What's
pull
that?
It, you have to remove it from the property?
It depends on the stage of development of the seeds. If it's just in starting to bloom, the easiest thing to do is, if it's just starting to bloom and you're going to pull it, just go out when it's just starting to bloom and you can identify it by the first white flowers. You can pull it out and leave it there. This is what I do at my property. Okay,
great.
A few places, okay, just yank it right out when it's just starting to bloom. Go out after a rain when the soil is damp, and you can get 95% of them, and you don't have to carry them off, bag them up, or do anything. Just leave them there. And if you have any question whatsoever as to the development of the seeds, if you have some heads that are finished blooming but don't have mature seeds, just break those seed heads, those young seed heads, off from the plant so they are not connected to the plant, so the plant and the root cannot continue to send energy into those seed heads and potentially mature them. Okay, so just pull them off. You pull a plant out of the ground and pull all any seed heads off. But if those seeds have started to really form and solidify, and you'll see the head of the Queen Anne's lace starts to close up when the seed is ripening. It's going to be very distinctive. If there's any question at all, put it in your pocket or bring a pail and get it out of there.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. Let's see. Gail in Oshkosh wondered how to get rid of an abundance of purslane in her flower garden.
Purslane. That is the best weed you could possibly have. Purslane, Portulaca oleraceae, is an annual. It's a plant that does wonders. We really like to see purslane in a first year prairie seeding, because it has a tap root, So it doesn't compete hardly at all at the rooting zone, and it spreads out across the ground. And it's like a free mulch that Mother Nature gives us. Purslane and also carpet weed, Malugo verticillata. These are my favorite weeds in a first-year prairie seeding because they hold the moisture in. And when you lift up those mats, you'll see the moisture in the soil, which then encourages the germination of the prairie seeds that you seeded either the previous fall or that spring. In a garden situation where it's between your plants, that means that you have too much open soil between your plants. And the typical American garden is usually a lot of mulch with a few plants interspersed in it. And so we have this idea that the plants need to be separated, so each one is its own little specimen. And so if you don't mulch it, you have open soil, and that's where all the weeds grow, including the purslane. So you can do what the English do and design a garden so that the plants complement one another, and their root systems and their foliar growth patterns are such that they cover all of the soil and all of the foliar zones, so light can't get down to the ground where the weeds will germinate, and you've got roots in the ground, so there's no open soil. So if you pack the plants in more closely, then you will have much, much less issues with weeds. And I should point out also that purslane is an excellent addition to your salad, and it's loaded with vitamins A and C. It's a little mucilaginous, but you'll get used to it.
I've had people say, guests on the show say, why do people put so much mulch down? Why don't they just pack in plants like the English do?
It's so true, isn't it, Larry? It's just crazy. But you know what? We are brainwashed with these idiotic ways of gardening, and I don't know where it comes from. But, I mean, you drive around and you see these giant piles of mulch, and you just wonder, oh, is this a garden or is this just like a place where people dumped all their mulch? It's just like, it's crazy. But that's the style, and that's what we're told is the appropriate garden. But I think, you know, gradually this is changing, and people are starting to come to their senses, and they're starting to plant communities of native plants and shrubs and flowers and grasses and all these wonderful, wonderful plants that support all these different butterflies, insects, pollinators, et cetera. And we're seeing this never-ending interest and growth in the last few years, which is really, really encouraging, considering that 40 years ago when I started doing this, I couldn't give this stuff away, and they were all weeds. And now it's growing rapidly, and people realize this is the future. This is the way of the future for the gardens that are going to support wildlife, pollinators, and us.
Give me a yes or no on this. Have you finished your book yet?
The book is in review at the University of Chicago Press, and we are waiting for the galley proofs, which we don't know when that's going to happen, but it's moving forward with a supposed publication date in 2022 for The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's good news. And on that happy note, Neil, I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be on your wonderful show.
Neil DeBoer, president of Prairie Nursery. He'll be back, and when that book comes out, we'll definitely have him on to talk about that book. So looking forward to that. Looking forward to Monday, we talk about with a couple of climate experts on the show about how climate change affects where people live and also how it's changing our seasons here in the state. That's Monday. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay with us, though. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.